Hello, I'm Andrew Tuck and you're listening to The Big Interview. My guest today is a designer, academic and creative director. Her way of thinking and work are at the DNA of spaces such as Soho House New York and the Ett Hem Hotel in Stockholm. She's collaborated with numerous brands, including designing the airline lounge concept for Cathay Pacific and creating a collection of affordable, quality furniture for IKEA. More than just designing interiors, however, Ilse Crawford creates environments where she prioritizes us, designing products and spaces where people can feel truly comfortable in a deep psychological way. From her early days as a journalist and creator of the UK version of Elle Decoration magazine, to being vice president of home product at Donna Karan, Ilse now runs her London-based studio Ilse and also founded the Man and Wellbeing department at the prestigious design academy Eindhoven, where she's nurturing a new generation of students to think about design as so much more than surface or soft furnishings. And I'm pleased to say that Ilse Crawford joins me in the studio today. Well, Ilse, thank you so much for joining us. It's amazing looking through your CV. It starts off in journalism. It moves fully into design. You work with big brands and small. You now have helped teach other people about that world of design. Let's go back to the beginning, though. When did you know that that was the world you wanted to enter? Was that as young as being a teenager? You knew that design was pulling you along?
No, is probably putting it too strongly, but really I never thought about the world in any other way, but possibly I learned that there was a name for it later on. But even as a very young kid, I was brought up in a family where we made everything ourselves, really. There wasn't any question that you went out and bought things. So, you know, whether it was dyeing your own clothes, making your own clothes, painting the walls, being the first at the jumble sale, you know, really we were in charge of our own worlds and given the freedom to do that. And then I think I became increasingly fascinated by how people seem to be affected by their surroundings.
Now, from the way that you speak about it, that use of the word affected, so from the beginning, and we'll dive into this more later on, it isn't about just the superficial, because many young people feel they're into design because they care about how they look or how they present themselves or how they construct an image. But if you were already then, you knew it was about something beyond the surface.
Yes. You know, post-rationalization is always a tricky thing. But certainly, as a child, as a teenager, I was lucky enough to be in the kind of family where we did sort of gather together around the big table. My parents were both pretty unconventional. I had a rather arty mother and a journalist father, neither of whom paid much heed to convention. So the house we lived in essentially had a table tennis table, a large kitchen table, and two armchairs. And that was sort of it as far as furniture was concerned. But of course, that gave us terrific freedom and awareness that, for example, when our friends came over, and they came over a lot because our house was freer than theirs, they immediately, you know, sat around the kitchen table, followed by long spells in the table tennis room and, you know, never went anywhere else. So it was very obvious to me that the way that you program space, not just the way it looks, but the way that people come together in space is really important and powerful in bringing people together.
And also upbringing fascinating then. So you were given that freedom of expression and the idea that it's good to experiment from an early age. Do you look back now at those years with your parents and feel how valuable they were for the work you do now then?
I think so. You know, around the kitchen table was where all ages came together. My father was quite a stickler. We had to justify any opinion we had, but we could have any opinion. I remember being a sort of communist, outspoken one, aged about 10. But, you know, I was allowed to be whatever I wanted to be, so long as I could justify it. And I think that that's probably stuck in there. I think having the two very different parents was good, and, you know, understanding that there are many points of view. And also just the fact that there was tolerance for all sorts of points of view in our house. I mean, you know, around the table, whether it was a table tennis table or the kitchen table, all sorts of people sat, you know, whether it was one of my sister's punk friends. And I remember my father sort of, you know, just saying, pass the gravy, spit. It was a tolerant household. And I think that I like to think that I follow that mindset today. Having said that, the harder side of life kicked in. It was kind of bumpy. I would say my mum's mental health was not always on a level. But, you know, that was part of our norm. And then she got really quite sick. And so we spent a lot of time in and out of hospitals where I saw how brutal, actually, unintentionally, absolutely, but how brutal institutional spaces can be and how dehumanising. So that, I think, again, all fed into a way of looking at the world where I saw environments as one part of making the world a more humanistic, more human-friendly place to be.
And the journey then from having those issues around you and those tough things to deal with as a kid and as a teenager, was it difficult focusing on your own academic career and your own professional career and knowing what to do next? Were you caught up in many things at that time, I guess?
Yeah. You know, financially, things were far from easy. My dad was widowed and left with five kids and promptly fired from his job by Murdoch. And there, that was tough. So I had to work to get myself through university, which I think actually really made me value university. I knew how important it was, you know, especially when you talk to ladies who'd worked at Debenhams and Woolworths and so on for a long time. They made it very clear they thought I should stick with university. So yeah, you know, it wasn't an easy ride, should we put it that way. And when I left university, what was good was I had worked, actually. So I didn't find it hard to get a job, and I was quite driven, no question. I could write. That came very easily to me. I actually got a job in journalism quite quickly as a sub-editor in the Architectural Journal. And then following that path through several publications, through World of Interiors and then El Decoration.
Now, the world of journalism was actually very good for you. You became the launch editor of El Deco, you know, a magazine that still continues and still thrives. And it was a big moment with that launch. I remember when it came out, how excited people were to see it. There wasn't a kind of a design magazine for that part of the population. What did you want to achieve?
I took the job and was excited to take the job because I felt that there was a massive gap for a magazine that spoke to me and my generation, that was contemporary, but in a warm and accessible way. Because as you say, the context was either rather sort of English country house-ish on the one hand, quite rarefied, or country cottagey and Laura Ashley-ish on the other. It was far from easy because the publisher invited me into his office and showed me a kind of stitched-together magazine that basically had a spread from every other magazine that was published at the time. But I dug my heels in. And it took a while, but with the team that I'd assembled, mostly people sort of ex-art school creatives, but again, as driven as I was to make a magazine that was very different to the competition and spoke to them. But with that team, I think we managed to make something that, yeah, basically is now a category in and of itself. I mean, it's obviously now very much an established title, but it wasn't. And it's important to remember all of these things have to be made at some point, and very much against, nearly always, quite some opposition. I remember having to take the magazine to Paris pre-publication in the early years, and this very nice, but really quite determined editor-in-chief in Paris used to go through each spread and say, that is good taste, that is bad taste. That is good taste, that is bad taste. And apparently there were more often, more in the latter category. And my nickname in Paris apparently was Denis the Menace.
And you've continued to menace a few people, hopefully, along the way. But when you look back at those issues of the magazine, or when you think about that time, was it an opportunity to work out a bit of a manifesto about the things that you believed in? Because when you saw those early copies of the magazine, it wasn't just about paint colour and lampshades. It was about something underneath all that about making spaces that you felt comfortable in that reflected your life and that made you feel at ease. Even then, were you aware that you were pushing the publisher in a direction which I guess many interiors magazines, they have a very set focus group of who they're after and the kinds of advertisers. You were kind of unpacking it in a more interesting way.
That was the intention, for sure. And very early on, we decided that the sort of basic premise of the magazine should be modern and emotional. So the idea was to basically inspire and give the tools to people to be able to make their own environments that spoke to them and that felt comfortable and particular to their own life story. And, you know, remember, this was before the internet. So really giving access to smaller companies, individual makers, alongside the Habitats and Conran shops and all of the other retailers was quite radical and made a real difference, because ultimately, if they're all there together on a page, it's really then up to the individual to choose.
Why did you leave journalism?
10 years is quite a long time in journalism. And I think that I knew I didn't really want to go on and edit another magazine. That was not my destiny. I wanted to get my hands dirty and I wanted to actually affect real places and not just be thrown away at the end of the month. So my interest was to figure out how to actually get out there. I met Nick Jones at that point and worked on Babington House. And that went rather well. I mean, he asked me initially to come in and help him with the colours, but in my usual bossy boots way, I told him that I didn't think that was the right idea, and that although it was a house in the country, it shouldn't be a country house hotel. It should really be a place that felt like the kind of house that a Soho House member would, in their dreams, go to for the weekend, where the parents had gone away and left the keys to the drinks cabinet. So essentially to try to keep the house-like quality and not institutionalise it, not turn it into a quote-unquote hotel, which he did. And obviously the rest is history. But I then went off to New York, where I had been offered a job with Donna Karan to develop her homewares range. Interestingly, she hadn't even heard of L Decoration. She approached me because of a book I'd written called Sense Your Home, which was a project I'd done for myself, writing in the early hours, researching for myself, because I'd become very uncomfortable, I would say, with the realisation that so many of the interior spaces that I went into felt cold. And although they look good in pictures, they really didn't feel good in the flesh.
So two little questions here. First of all, I think most people who are journalists and they're writing about a sector or they're writing about a world, that confidence to leap over the hedge and go from critic to practitioner is one that must feel formidable. But it sounds like you didn't look over your shoulder once. It sounds like you had the confidence to make that leap and know that your skill set was kind of there.
I would never have described myself as confident. I think I was extremely nervous of the whole thing, but I knew I had to. I had something inside of me just pushing me. I knew I had to do it. And maybe that's also one of the positive things that comes out of the bad thing of losing a parent quite young. I was very aware that, you know, life might not go on very long. You know, my mother died before she was 40. And, you know, the idea that you just had to get on with it, that time didn't wait for you, that things didn't come to you, you really had to make it happen yourself, has really always been burnt into me.
Now, you then went on to set up doing the work, obviously, for Nick Jones in the Soho House Group, but many other clients as well. You set up your own studio and quickly gained a reputation as being very good at what you did. Now, I have a sense of what I think your success and design skills are, but tell me, when you look at your body of work, what would be one or two of the threads that you think connect all of those projects?
Fundamentally, I think I am more interested in how design affects people. So we start always from the point of view of the strategy rather than how it looks. And whether that's on a small scale or a big scale, it's always the same. So first of all, we need to interrogate, really understand what's going on before we come up then with a concept and then turn that into a finished design. Throughout that process, we're always obsessed by how the end result can connect physically, how it can make the normal special, how it can really embed those unmeasurable values. Because so often throughout the process of building, or indeed designing products, if you like, the cold system can eradicate those more humanistic values. You know, time, money, a million other things get in the way of what I think are the most important values, you know, which are essentially those around well-being and making spaces that bring out the best in us.
Because I presume, you know, if somebody goes to Ethem, the amazing hotel you did in Stockholm, it's a house, almost come hotel, where you feel that you are almost the owner of the hotel while you're staying there. If they go to Duddles, the club you did in Hong Kong, or if they go to a Cathay Pacific lounge, there's so much thought and emotion and sensory skill that goes into that. When people describe you, and I see, you know, on many lists, you know, one of the top 10 or the top whatever interior designers, do you think that word or that job title, is it one you smart from or one you embrace?
Decorator, I think, is the one that I feel a little bit whatever about. In a sense, I think interior designer has been devalued as a tag, but actually I'm proud of it because, you know, we spend 87% of our lives inside buildings. So I think designing the insides of buildings is really important and should be reappraised. It's so important that the spaces that we make for people are taken seriously and that that is factored in at the very beginning of a building process, because you'd be surprised so often, partly because of the way that buildings are commissioned. Sometimes the interior is not really considered till the very end of the process when time and money has run out, you know, and it should be something that's thought about at the very beginning because it's part of the very identity of the building. If it's a business, it's part of the business position of that building. It's something that needs to last. It needs to be considered in terms of where the ingredients come from, how the money will be spent. I mean, it's so integral to the very core of any project. So I think the most important thing is to relook at what interior design means.
You've said before that a good designer should be an agent for change. Now, that can be everything from sustainability, as you've said, to how we feel. And you've worked with everyone from, you know, luxury brands through to, you know, a really popular brand like IKEA. Is that one of the most important things that you want out of a project when you take it on, that you can be that agent for change?
When we look at a project, we always look at the whole system. I call it humanomics. So whatever the scale, whatever the budget, we look at what it is, what it could be. So, for example, with the IKEA project, here you have a company with an enormous reach and extremely strict criteria. Now, obviously, we all dream of a world where massive international companies didn't exist and everything was provided by nice locals making them for you, which is clearly, you know, it's not realistic. So how can you work with a big company to reach a big audience whilst making small but realistic changes that could have a huge effect? So that was what was so compelling, really, about IKEA, is how to reach that big audience, how we could use their system, you know, how we could understand their system and design in a way that could actually make a big difference on that scale. You know, just a small change on that massive scale could have a huge effect. So by using natural materials, cork, glass, ceramic, water hyacinth, etc., we were able to make products that essentially were cradle to cradle, that would disappear when they disappeared, that were made ethically. We went to the factories to see where they were made, how they were made, the conditions they were made in, and yet were made at prices that people could afford. So I think that was the challenge there, and it was a really interesting one. On the other hand, if you look at a project like ETHEM or even Cathay Pacific, there you have a different set of circumstances. There you have the possibility to make a place with a relatively generous budget. But then the question is, where does that money go? In the case of Cathay, we really pushed to channel the funds for the project to small companies, real companies, companies that really had soul, companies like Vitso, who make the Dieter Rams chairs, Kalmar, who have been around since the 20s, 30s, Lobmeyer, Carl Hansen, you know, the really good smaller companies. When it came to ETHEM, it was a question of looking at the very notion of what a high-end hotel is, what it represents, what it could represent today. In that case, it was a small-ish building, so it's only 12 rooms. But we focused on the notion of it being about care and attention, that that meant that you had to really care for your staff as much as for the guests, and looked at designing it so that there's really no distinction between front and back of house. You are in the hands of people who are professionals and whose job it is to take care of you, but it's not part of that old school luxury hotel model. When I was asked to start the Department of Man and Wellbeing in 2000, I leapt at the chance because I felt it'd be a really interesting way to be able to just unpack the ideas behind design and figure out how to make it much more normal to prioritize people, how to create processes where actually you start from the point of view of the human experience.
But that thought of affecting change, I know it's coming to life now in a project that you're doing with Massimo Bottura, which is a project to create a space here in London which will make a dining room and a kitchen to feed homeless people. It's a way of connecting food waste to good food, to a sense of community, and again, affecting people's mental health. You know, it links back to the things we spoke about at the beginning of this interview. There you're going out of your way when you could be working on a nice luxury mall or a hotel or something to put aside some time to work for the homeless. Why does that appeal to you?
I mean, in setting up the studio, my ideal has always been that on the one hand, we would have work which paid us appropriately, which would mean I could pay my team well and that we could work in good conditions. So that was important to me. But then once we got to a state of sort of reasonable financial health, I wanted to be able to do projects for those who couldn't afford to pay us. So I've always wanted to, and in fact, we historically have done a number of projects of this nature. And what I love about this particular project, the Food for Soul project, is it's such a clear and apparently simple idea. And they're the best because they're the ones that can spread and that become universal. And Bottura's concept is the idea of combining the issue of food waste, so supermarket surplus, and combining that with soup kitchens, bringing those two together, which then means that chefs are very keen to get involved, young chefs, and then bringing designers into the mix. And our brief was glorious, actually, which was simply to make it beautiful. When you share that with people who haven't got any knowledge of the project, sometimes they look at you and go, what? But it is absolutely brilliant because by making beautiful environments, they become dignified. It's also sustainable because it means that when they're not used as soup kitchens, they can be rented out to corporates or other clients, which means that the whole thing's supported. So essentially, it's a brilliantly simple circle. And it's interesting because sometimes when we're talking to the younger students, maybe just joined the Design Academy, they're in the foundation years, so, and we talk about design, and they'll sort of say something like, well, you know, I don't want to do anything to do with aesthetics. I want to do social design. And, you know, that's great. I understand where that's coming from. But equally, you also have to throw it back, which is basically, you know, so are you saying that social projects shouldn't be beautiful, that they should be ugly? and they kind of get a bit freaked out at that. I think it's really important. I mean, one of my sisters is actually mentally very unwell, and she's been in institutions for long periods of time. And the people that work in those places are amazing. But the places themselves are horrendous. You know, the blue lino, the melamine cups, the bright light, the horrible acoustics, the signs everywhere. They are dehumanising at best. And that's not just for the people who have to stay there. It's the people who work there too. So actually, I think those are the places more than ever that need good design.
And tell me, that feeling of going to see your sister in an institution, or knowing your mum has been in the same situation, and you know the power of good design, does it make you angry when people have cut those corners and decided, actually, you know, the same shitty chair in every institution is fine, and the same kind of bland surroundings, the same magnolia walls will do just fine? Does it make you angry, our access to design?
It makes me angry, but I do understand where it comes from, and it's essentially the sort of de-risking, functionalistic, wipe clean approach. And you understand where it comes from, and they don't have money, you know. And the problem, I think, is that the way those things are commissioned, it's obviously done on very tight budgets by people with very little time, and often the wrong people, you know, who are more worried about the issues around, you know, health and safety and so on, which are not non-issues. They're very important issues. But it is possible to integrate those with joy. You don't always have to prioritise the sort of hose-down solution in all of those cases. And I think taking time and care to make those places better is a great priority.
And finally, just tell me, you know, an amazing sense of emotion and feeling and consideration going into design. Just as a final thought, when you look around at the design that you see being delivered to us today, whether that's in architecture or in product or in the spaces we inhabit, do you think that people are beginning to understand what started as, you know, a journalistic career where you were encouraging people to think about these issues, you know, literally decades ago? Do you think we have cut through? Do you think there is a feeling that design could take us in the right direction?
I think design is a magical process because it allows you to basically absorb the different streams of information, to reach an understanding. And by following through that process, and it is important that you delay gratification and don't sort of try to do the how before the what, by following that through to its conclusion, you can come to some really great and surprising alternatives to the solutions that we have today. But it is important to take time. And that, I think, is one of the challenges for designers, because I think design has become known as a sort of stylistic response, as a look, even as a rather elitist thing. Whereas actually, no, design is a process. And I think that is what makes it so universal. It can be applied to so many different areas, but followed through, it can create authentic, sustainable, even human responses to changing conditions. And I think we need that today more than ever.
Ilse Crawford, thank you so much for your big interview. The Big Interview is produced by Gaia Lutz and it's edited by Deya Cesar. Until next time, all that's left to say is goodbye and thank you for listening.